He seems like he has an uncanny ability to put the bat on the ball and put the ball in play.
If it is harder for Pilar to swing the bat, he might take a few more pitches, and this might be a blessing in disguise. Politely tell them, hey, this isn't my first party with balloons there, friend. They're going to lose a bit.
And welcome to Artificial Turf Wars, episode number 24, where we start out as special advisor and then retire to play baseball. I am your host, Greg Wisniewski, and I am joined tonight by Nick Dyka. Nick, how you doing?
Greg, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Josh was unable to make it as he is stopping the seal hunt, from what I've heard. It's just a rumor. But on to baseball, the Jays are 3-3 since we last talked. We've got Pilar going on the DL. We have not too much offense. We have Scott Feldman. There was a development. We talked a lot about Aaron Sanchez last time, and now we can go into what happened to the rotation due to all that drama. Then we're going to talk. Actually, we're going to expand our horizons a little bit about Tex, A-Rod, and Prince Fielder. Because all those guys might not be in baseball come this time next week. And I think that's probably will get us through the show. No interview this week. You just get stuck with Nick and I. Can you handle Nick?
Oh, I've got at least 2.5 hours worth of content to deliver. So it's going to be a struggle to try to cram it into 40 minutes, but we'll try.
Put your seatbelts on, folks. Here we go. 3-3. I guess 3-3 is not a bad week if you're near the top of the division, which the Jays are. They started the night tied for the top of the division. We're recording this, of course, Tuesday night, a little early. But I don't know if that's going to be good enough going forward. What do you see as like, what do the Jays need to do or need to change to get out of that? Because I think it was a 3-3 week the last time we did a podcast, too. There's a lot of that going around.
It was, yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously the biggest issue in this last week and a half has been the offense. And, you know, much like at the beginning of the year, it's surprising. Whenever the Jays' kind of woes can be laid on their hitters, it doesn't feel like that should be a problem. Obviously, I think we're seeing, you know, Saunders struggle and maybe regress a little bit. You know, his first half was, I would assume, his best half of baseball ever. Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
And I, you know, when I checked in June, his BABIP was, I think, over 350. So I think, you know, between Saunders, Melvin has not been good since the trade. And, you know, now with Jose back, but not totally hitting like the Batista we've come to know. It's odd to think of the offense as kind of the thing that needs to be improved. But I think that seems like what's been the major problem this last week. And luckily for, you know, the Blue Jays and Blue Jays fans, their offense is something that should correct itself just by virtue of the fact that the Jays hitters are way better than how they've been hitting the last 10 days or so.
So if you look at it, starting with the loss last Monday against the Astros, the Jays scored 1 run, 2 runs, 3 runs, 4 runs, 4 runs, 2-1, then 7, and everyone yesterday went, oh, yeah, it's fantastic, everybody's okay, and then tonight they scored 2, and unfortunately, due to Marco Estrada not being Marco Estrada, for whatever reason, they got shellacked, like, 9-2. Go ahead.
Yeah, Drew Smiley seems to be a pitcher that I would think the Jays would be able to really tune up. You know, a lefty with homer problems, I thought tonight would definitely be another big offensive night. But I find the Jays surprise you in the sense that the pitchers they're able to handle. You know, I've seen them come back against Herrera and Craig Kimbrel, and then every once in a while a pitcher that just doesn't seem to be somebody who should be able to stymie the team is able to just kind of shut them down.
I think last year versus left-handers versus this year versus left-handers is a shocking drop-off. Like you would rather see them face a right-hander this year, which is weird, considering right. how much righty power is in that lineup. I don't know if that's overcompensation, knowing they're going to see more right-handers, or...
Yeah.
I don't understand.
No.
I know the splits are supposed to work.
It's essentially the same lineup, too. You know, minus Saunders and Travis. So you wouldn't think they'd be that much different of a team this year in terms of their ability to handle lefties. But, well, here we are, I guess.
And I wanted to go to Travis because on Monday night he had his first four-hit game of his career. And presumptive of me to be surprised that was the first four-hit game of his career, even though he's in his sophomore season? He seems like he has an uncanny ability to put the bat on the ball and put the ball in play, which is really lacking in today's game, generally speaking, unless you're Jose Altuve.
Yeah, well, okay, I'm going to call this now. You heard it here first. If this keeps up for another week, everybody's going to be talking about giving Travis Jose Bautista's money come the offseason. I think if he stays on fire for just a little bit longer, I think we're going to start to hear talk of Travis as the new kind of white knight for the Jays. But I think it's still so early in his career, and he's got what I think 400, not even 400 at bats in the major leagues as of today, and if not slightly over. And so I do think we still need to take a wait and see approach. And I know a lot of people were advocating for that coming into the season. And given that he missed so much of the first half, I think we still need to kind of take that position. And that's not to say I think he's going to be terrible or the Jays haven't struck gold in him. But, you know, especially with young players coming up, it seems that so much of the initial, you know, first two or three years of a player's career is about, you know, adjusting to the league, then the league makes adjustments to them, then they need to in turn make adjustments back. And so, you know, seeing how Travis kind of handles that, I think will be important before we really do kind of run with him as being the, and making it safe to assume that he's the player we see now. That said, you're completely right. He does seem to make a lot of contact and, you know, hit the ball. He hits the ball the other way so well that I think to have him lengthen the lineup is going to be like a really great thing, especially given he's another young player that's cost controlled and not going to make the Blue Jays older because they are a very old team too. Yeah.
I think knowing the Blue Jays history, I don't think there's any danger of them locking up a player who has 4 years control left. Because the last guy they did anything close to that with was Ricky Romero, and that worked out famously. But they've been loath to do that sort of thing, period. So I don't think that's, you know, I don't think he gets Jose Bautista's money anytime soon. Maybe they just put that in a pocket somewhere and try and work things out. But I would love for him to be an everyday fixture at second base. I totally would. Speaking of young players, Kevin Pillar this week did something he's never done before, and it wasn't a good thing. He went to the disabled list. Now, you have seen, and I have seen, any number of diving into turf, slamming into the wall, leaping grabs, all that kind of stuff. And that's not where he hurt himself. He hurt himself sliding into second base. So he's out for 15 days. Now, that's a awfully good time for the Blue Jays to have picked up a guy who could legitimately back up in center field. That was like a psychic moment someone had, because I would much rather, as much as Melvin Upton is not hitting right now, Melvin Upton can play center field, which Ezekiel Carrera just sort of shows up in center field. So I think that's worked out well as a depth move.
Absolutely. Like you said, Ezekiel Carrera is more stationed in center field than plays center field, and Upton is definitely a big league center fielder, and he has been for a long time. So I think that it's one of those moves that, you know, when it happens, and I know everybody's talked about this, but it's not the most exciting thing to get a guy like Upton at the trade deadline. But it doesn't take a lot to see why guys like Upton are important, because we would be looking at Carrera in center field or Siciliani, or any other number of suboptimal options out there. And I think it does show to the kind of like the methodical nature of the Jays front office staff to be able to pick up a guy like Upton, who is definitely a serviceable player and one that I think is going to help the Jays over the next 15 days in ways that any of the Jays' other options wouldn't have helped them.
Now, they were talking last night on the broadcast, and I didn't quite hear it all, but apparently they're not even sure Pilar is going to be healed up after 15 days. They're trying to come up with some kind of wrap or brace or something so that he can play even if he isn't 100%. I always hate to hear that, because I think usually the player does worse than he would if he just let himself heal up and let someone else bat in his stead.
Oh, for sure. I mean, look at how Russ Martin was hitting when he had the neck injury in April and May. Not hitting, yeah, exactly.
There's all kinds of examples of that. And I mean, you do hear about guys, oh, he had a sports hernia and he played for 3 months and he was great. But generally speaking, there's inability to make hard contact. There's inability to get to inside or outside pitches. And other teams see that quickly and exploit it. And you can't just put the guy back on the disabled list. Like, you got to be sure that you can work around it to your advantage. And I don't think there's any way really to be sure when it's a hand injury. I mean, if it's a leg, or if it's a oblique or something, maybe it only bothers you one way or another. But you got to grip the bat, right?
Yeah. Oh, exactly. And I mean, we've seen, I know he didn't break his hamate bone, but we've seen hand injuries zap a lot of people's, zap a lot of people's power. And although one thing we could consider is if it is harder for Pilar to swing the bat, he might take a few more pitches, and this might be a blessing in disguise and just the birth of a new Kevin Pillar, patient hitter at the plate.
Yeah, reluctant hitter. Very reluctant hitter.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that would be a whole new talent for him, the taking of pitches. I always know a pitcher's struggling when he's walked Pillar on four. I know there's problems there. Like, you shouldn't have done that.
the most surprising at bat I ever watched last season was in Game 6 of the LCS when Pilar drew that walk against Wade Davis. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, you're like, yeah. Bizarro world.
Yeah, I remember sitting there thinking, where was this guy all year? But no, hopefully, regardless if it's 15 days or a little bit longer, hopefully he does come back full strength, because if he doesn't, then you do get into those messy situations where it would have been better for him just to sit out the extra time as opposed to come back and hurt the team.
This is going to give Josh Tolley a leg up in the who will have the most walks by the end of the season race, though.
That's true.
At least in the short run, those 2 weeks, Tolley's going to get 3 starts.
Yeah, maybe more.
Anybody's game.
Yeah.
I don't know who's playing the game, but it's anybody's game, as it were. Do you want to talk about the 6-man rotation, or do you want to talk about Scott Feldman?
Let's start with the 6-man.
Yeah. Okay, so that was the big drama last week, was Aaron Sanchez is going. No, he's not. Yes, he is. To the bullpen. Could be, but he's not. But we haven't talked to him. But we want to, but we have to, but we can't, but we shouldn't. And right. He's not. Okay, for sure. wow. Yeah, that was like 3 days worth of Aaron Sanchez. And we ended up with Aaron Sanchez in the starting rotation, where I'm happy to have him. And we have a six-man starting rotation. That was the elegant solution. And again, nothing has been set in stone, right?
Right. And I guess the one thing that comes to mind for me immediately with the six-man rotation is one of the criticisms seems to be that it throws pitchers off their routine and the extra rest is not necessarily always a good thing. But the thing that I don't totally understand about that is pitchers have to throw on different amounts of rest if there's off days anyway. So given the Blue Jays off days coming up, I think most of the starters are going to be starting on 6 days rest. So they would have had an extra day of rest in between starts either way. And so I just don't understand why a six-man rotation is detrimental in a way that not managing a rotation to alleviate extra rest because of off days isn't. And it just seems to be like a selective application of resistance to the six-man rotation, because players, again, they have extra days all the time when there's off days or the rotation gets rearranged for one reason or another. So I think it's something that can work. That said, the results haven't been so great so far.
I don't know if that's really causation there.
<It's>, yeah.
Liriano, he got through six innings with two earned runs allowed and one unearned. So that wasn't too bad. I think Marco Estrada, I think Marco Estrada needs maybe more rest. I don't think his back is 100%.
No.
So I think a part of that factoring in the six that people have mentioned, the six man, is to give Estrada that same extra breather and maybe help him out, help him his recovery time to get him back up to he never threw more than 90 miles an hour, but to get him up to that velocity that he was at before. He just didn't have the control. After the game that we are recording this, he went with four walks. That's not Marco Estrada, not in five innings. I think it'll shake out sooner or later. And I mean, if one guy turns out to be awful, well, now you've got someone immediately who can replace him, and you roll back to five men and you try and use the off days as best you can.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see them run with it for as long as they can, because given Estrada's back and Sanchez's workload concerns, you know, I know you have to get there first, but the idea of starting the playoffs without either of them in the rotation does not seem ideal at all. So if there's any planning that they can do now to try to get Estrada's back as healthy as it can be and keep Sanchez's workload to a point that's manageable enough that he can continue to start come October, which I understand that doesn't sound like it's going to happen, but any way to kind of keep those two with the give those two the most starts they can get in the most important games, I think would be ideal. I'd say run with the six man, and unless there's really something that, you know, if something goes horribly wrong.
The other very infrequently mentioned man is Marcus Stroman. There's nothing in Marcus Stroman's history that says he's a 200-inning workhorse. I'm not trying to knock him, but I'm saying I don't think it's even fair to him to say, well, yeah, you can just show up and throw 220 innings if we go into the playoffs, or 230. Yeah, no big deal. He's right. Never, you know, he's not done that either. So if everybody gets a breather and Liriano is you know, fifth starter good or fourth starter good, then fantastic. Obviously, Ari Dickey's going to take his turn every 5 days, and he's going to be the same mysterious enigma that he's been for the last 3 years. And Jay Happ is ready to take the workload. So, yeah, I don't think we really disagree here. I think the way the Blue Jays handled it is still just one of the dumber things I've ever seen.
Yeah, I don't wholly understand it either, but you guys went into that last week. But yeah, on the Stroman point though, it's not even that Stroman's kind of a junk baller, because Stroman throws hard as well, And that, for all the unknowns with workload and injury risk for young pitchers, I think the one thing that is established is that higher velocity does increase your risk of injury as a pitcher. And it's not like Stroman's throwing 7 or 8 miles an hour slower than Sanchez a lot of the time. You know, Stroman's in the low to mid 90s a lot. So yeah, it's kind of confounding why they are so concerned with Sanchez and they haven't made a peep about Stroman.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to go to Scott Feldman now. Scott Feldman was exchanged for... Okay, I'm even confused. I lost track of who he was exchanged for. All I know is he's not been very good.
No. No.
I pulled up his game log. Since joining the Blue Jays, he was in Houston. He gave up a run on 2 hits, did not record an out, and lost the game. Which is an infinite ERA, for those of you who are keeping track. Then he had a clean inning against Kansas City on the 5th. Then he gave up 3 runs in 1.1 innings, or 1 inning and a third, on the 7th. And then he came in on the 9th tonight and gave up 4 runs on 6 hits in 2 innings. Now, to be fair, he was kind of dribbled and flipped and dropped to death in the inning that I did see him pitch tonight, but at the same time he didn't have any swing and miss pitches. Did the Jays make a mistake picking him up? I have no idea.
I think the Feldman acquisition is a lot like the trade of Joaquin Benoit for Drew Storen, in the sense that the Jays had a not great pitcher occupying Feldman's role in Jesse Chavez. Chavez wasn't pitching well either. He's given up a lot of home runs. You know, by getting Feldman, there was always, you know, Feldman was never been a world beater. There's never, you know, nobody thought they were getting an elite reliever or a top line starter or anything like that. I think the worst thing that could have happened is basically Feldman was as bad as Chavez was. So I think I understand the idea behind acquiring him, because there's nowhere to go but up. The same way with Joaquin Benoit. You know, Storen was bad. He was going to continue to be bad. Benoit might be bad, but there's a chance he could be better. And so, yeah, how Feldman is going to shake out is still up for debate. But in terms of what the Jays had as options to improve the team, it was a pretty low risk way to maybe get some better production out of that swingman spot that they weren't getting with Chavez. And up until the trade, Feldman was having an all right year. I don't see anything that suggests he might not be able to, you know, revert to the pitcher he was in Houston for the last couple of years. So I wouldn't worry too much, given it's only been a week.
So, interestingly, you mentioned Joaquin Benoit. He has worked out. He is the Jason Grilley 2.0, pretty much like the Jays were hoping for. He's given up in 7 outings since he joined the Jays. I have 3 hits and 5 walks. Yeah. And no runs.
Yeah. Right.
Yay!
And the same reason I wouldn't freak out too much about Feldman yet, I wouldn't say that Benoit is kind of over the hump and back to the kind of dominant reliever he was the previous 3 or 4 years. You know, it's just such a, you know, anything can happen in a week's worth of relief appearances. And I think, you know, they might have found something, although 5 walks in 7 appearances is still not that great, and that's what Benoit was struggling with when he came to the team. I think that seemed to be, to me, the only major difference between Benoit of previous years and Benoit of this year is his walk rate was, I think, almost double what it was the last couple of seasons. So,
which is exactly what it was with Grilley. Grilley was walking like 5 per 9 or something before he got here. It was just ridiculous.
Right. Can we attribute this all to Russell Martin? You can frame away two or three walks per nine innings, right? That's happened.
Stick the glove and the walks evaporate.
Yeah.
I think we can get some of it from Russell Martin. I think some of it might actually be Pete Walker. If not a miracle worker, but I think you know, there's a certain mentality that he brings to the game. He has generally had teams with lower walk rates, whether that's because of the players they bring in or not, I'm not sure, but evidence seems to be leaning that he might have the right things to say to a guy who's struggling with his mechanics and can't keep the ball where he wants.
Well, that would be a boon for the Jays if the Jays kind of had Ray Searage 2.0 on the coaching staff.
He's the walk whisperer.
Yeah. Watch yourself, Searage. Walker's coming for you.
We don't know how that works exactly. The sad news, Danny Barnes, after today's 9-2 debacle, was designated for assignment, or optioned, I'm sorry, by the Blue Jays. So we get to play middle reliever sweepstakes. They're going to replace him with someone from Buffalo, presumably. Who's your money on? We talked about this before we came on the pod. There's not that many guys who are on the 40-man, first of all. But we'd all like to see Bo Schulz.
You mentioned, too, Bolsinger somehow got demoted twice in one day. So
that's, I'm sure that's a clerical error on someone's part. Sent to minors. Sent to minors again. The minors. They can't call Bo Schulz back up, even if they wanted to. It hasn't been 10 days yet. So we are looking at probably Ryan Tepera. Is that what we decided?
Yeah. Unless they're concerned with Cecil and they want to go with another lefty, then yeah, I think it's going to be Tepera for at least 3 or 4 days.
I don't suppose you have Aaron Loop's statistics up in front of you.
One second here. I think, though, ultimately, this is the kind of bullpen we're going to be resigned to kind of following for the rest of the year. They don't have, you know, those enough great pitchers kind of to occupy the back end of the bullpen, or sorry, the mid-level of the bullpen. So we're going to be seeing a lot of up and down, I think, from now until when the rosters expand. And so, you know, at AAA this year, Aaron Loop is 3-0 with a 0.68 ERA, with one save and 17 strikeouts.
Wow.
In 13 innings.
Because he did not look like that guy when I saw him for whatever it was, 4 or 5 outings off the disabled list in Toronto. He looked like a homer machine.
Yeah, it's that old saying, Greg. The major leagues are harder than AAA. You know, Drew Hutchinson muttered that to himself all the time, I think. But yeah, so my money's still on Tepera, though, I think.
They seem to like him.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll find out some obscure rule prohibiting that particular thing that we didn't know about next week, and we'll get letters and cards written in.
Yeah.
I think the thing about most bullpens is, though, that there is no one watching middle reliever sweepstakes holding their breath for anyone in particular. Whether you are the Cardinals or the Yankees or whoever else, you got those guys who are trying to cover when things don't go right for the starter, and they're not very good, because if they were any good, some other team would have them in the 8th or 9th inning.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. As exciting as it is to dream on Danny Barnes or, you know, whoever else kind of pops up. I remember after, yeah. Well, hey, that's one that's worked out at least a little bit, all right.
Yep.
He's kind of established himself as, I don't know what the 4th best reliever on the Jays, which is,
well,
fifth.
It depends on how you view Benoit. It's Osuna, Grilly, Osuna, Grilly, Cecil, because Cecil has been better despite his unfortunate mistake the other night where he gave up a grand slam. And Cecil's your lefty, right? Your go-to lefty. So I think those are the top three. And then you've got Benoit to cover the 7th inning. And then, yeah, is Joe Biagini number 4? Maybe.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if Biagini ends up usurping Benoit before the end of the season. I'm just not convinced Benoit is fixed just yet. Five and seven appearances is a lot.
As long as you're not giving up the hits with them, you're fine.
That's true. Okay.
So we have a couple listener questions here. I will refresh one more time just to see if there's any exciting... No, we still have two questions. So question number one. Right. These are both very deep questions. Question number one is from Minor Leaguer at Minor _ Leaguer, who has been on Twitter forever, who you probably already follow if you're a Jays fan. Why can't the Blue Jays win every game?
That's a very good question. It's one I ask myself as I'm throwing things around my living room, maybe, you know, 70 times a year, 80 or 90 in down years. But it's a good question. I think more importantly, I think it's a fair question, because they should be able to win every game. They've got good hitters. They've got good pitchers. Why aren't they running train on the rest of baseball? And then I think about it for a minute and realize it's because there's also some good hitters and good pitchers on other teams.
I think the one of the more downer moments for me in baseball is watching a team lose its first game of the season, whenever that is, day one, first week, whatever. And then thinking to myself, in the best of all possible worlds, I'm still going to watch that 60 more times in the next 6 months.
Oh yeah. You can't get too high and you can't get too low in baseball. It's just not going to work out for you if you do. And that was the interesting thing when the turnaround happened last year is, you know, you got a lot more kind of casual fans who, if they knew you liked baseball, would start bringing up baseball to you as the Jays were doing well. And then, you know, if they happened to lose a game and they asked you about it and you mentioned they lost, their hearts would break and they'd ask if you were okay or they'd swear. And then you'd have to just basically politely tell them, hey, this isn't my first party with balloons there, friend. They're going to lose a bit.
Yeah. The balloons will pop from time to time, and that's just how it goes.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's literally, with the schedule, it's 2.5 months of losing for a championship team.
Yeah.
Just thankfully, it's not all strung together. But I've watched so many 500-ish teams come through Toronto in the past, it's almost 10 years now. I am pleasantly surprised to see them at near or in a wild card position or at the top of the division or whatever else. I'm very pleasant about that. So games where they get blown out 9-2, I'm not happy, but I've come to terms with that. So the Blue Jays can't win every game because I can accept the fact that they don't, and my acceptance is allowing them to lose. So I'm sorry.
And I do think there is something too. Just, I know you were mentioning a lot of having to watch a lot of 500 teams. The nice thing about having the team that the Blue Jays have now is even when they are losing, they're not out of games. Well, they were out of tonight, but they're not out of games in the same way that a bad team is out of games. And that makes losing even tolerable in the sense that there's a lot of close games or games that you can watch all the way through being unsure if they're going to lose or not. Because to go back to those earlier incarnations of the Jays for most of the last 20 years, there was a lot of nights when, you know, Josh Towers was pitching, not to pick on him, but where you knew they were going to lose. And that can be deflating, even though in a way that following a good team is not, I think.
Yeah, I think the trade-off there is there's no stress to watching the crappy team, and a lot of people reflect on that as well as being the big deal, is it knowing they should be able to win every game and can be in a position to win every game is more stressful. I'm like, yeah, that's fair too. Would you like to go on to the even deeper question?
Sure.
Have you been watching the Olympics, first of all?
I watched a little bit of swimming on Sunday night, but I haven't had a chance to watch.
Actually, that might be the important one. Are you aware of the cupping phenomena?
Yes.
Okay. Can you explain to me
All I know is it involves suction cups. And believe it or not, our question does have something to do with this.
Okay.
Michael Phelps had marks on his shoulders. Yes? Was that?
Yeah. Or,
yeah. From cupping.
Right.
Which is supposed to make you what?
Now, I assume it did. I don't know if I had a chance to see it, but basically they look like circular over kind of his shoulder and pectoral. He had all these circular red marks that looked like either like birthmarks or something like that. I'm not exactly sure what cupping is. It's supposed to be some type of athletic recovery method or something. Is it pain? It might have to do with pain management. I assume Troy Tulowitzki has tried cupping at some point over the course of his career. You know, he's a guy who will go to the ends of the earth to make himself better. So, you know, if he's sleeping in hyper, you know, if he's sleeping in like crazy oxygen chambers that Novak Djokovic recommends, I'm sure he's tried cupping too. But okay. I don't know the science behind exactly how it helps you recover or deal with pain or anything like that. But I know that's what it's generally about.
So here's the question from...
Oh, that wasn't even the question.
No, the question is from Matthew Puro at Max the Silent. Should the Jays consider cupping therapy in an attempt to start their offense? And then it says below, Donaldson grabbing his crotch.gif. So I don't think that's the cupping that... Like, this is a family show, so we're only going to talk about suction cups.
I'm not going to swear this time. I apologize for last time.
I apologize for improperly handling my bleeps, because I really should have been able to do that. I think the Jays have napped together. I think that was probably as extreme as I'm willing to go with the unusual therapies. Nap therapy is probably the best idea to start the offense.
Yeah, I don't know how many, not to rag on baseball players, but I don't know how many of them have Michael Phelps's build either. So it might not necessarily work the same for, you know, Joaquin Benoit or Joe Biagini or something like that.
Are you imagining a situation where the cups get stuck somehow, that they're unable to remove them?
Yeah. It's very possible. It's very possible.
That's a horrible picture. It really is. Okay. We're going to move on because those were our only two interesting... those were our only two questions this week. So if you didn't like them, next week, I encourage you to tweet back at TurfPod or at Baseball Pro, and we'll be happy to answer your question. We had a couple... Well, three, as you pointed out to me, retirements pretty much this week. We had Mark Teixeira announcing he would be done at the end of the season. We had Alex Rodriguez announcing he'd be done at the end of the week. And then we had Cecil Fielder announcing he's already done because of injury. We think. That's tomorrow.
Prince.
Yeah. Prince. Cecil, did I do it? See, I called him Nelson Lariano last week, and I called him Cecil Fielder this week. Because I am not an old man. Just wanted to make that absolutely clear. So I was going to ask you about the most significant Mark Teixeira versus the Blue Jays moment. And then I realized I couldn't actually recall anything Mark Teixeira had done in his entire career with any significance at all.
He's been quietly very good for a long time. And over the last few years, he's been quietly not as good as he was at his peak. But, you know, all in all, Teixeira was a really good player for a really long time. I think part of that not having any signature moment against the Jays is the fact that when Teixeira was doing most of his damage in the American League, the Jays just weren't that great a team. And so, like you said, we were kind of more resigned to not winning than I'd say we were now or last year. But don't take anything away from Teixeira. He's a really good player, switch hitter. It'll be sad to see him go.
It's not a knock on his talent as a player. I didn't mean that at all. I just mean I literally, like, I see his face and I go, that's Mark Teixeira.
And I literally cannot remember it. I know he's hit. He's got some kind of switch hitting home run record, and I'm sure he's hit two home runs in the same game from both sides of the plate a bunch of times, and all this other stuff. And he was known for his glove work and everything. But to like picture him, like when you say Derek Jeter to me, right? You could see him flipping a baseball or sliding somewhere. There's a moment in his career where you go, yeah, that was the Derek Jeter thing. I really don't know any Mark Teixeira things, which probably my fault.
No, I mean, he was part of that 09 World Series team. That, I guess, to me, is the one that sticks out the most, I guess.
But that was A-Rod's coming out party in the playoffs, right? That was his big impact, right? Which is the other strange story was Alex Rodriguez was not getting any playing time in New York. And to have a DH on the bench might be the most useless thing in all of baseball. So they came to an agreement of some kind that he would finish his week, and that would be the end of it, and he would become a special advisor with the organization. So give me your signature Alex Rodriguez and the Blue Jays moment, if you have one.
Well, I guess in terms of with the Blue Jays, it's going to be the pop-up, which he ran interference on back in the – was that the late 90s? No, that was the early 2000s.
Early 2000s, yep.
Yeah.
Howie Clark?
Howie Clark. I'd say that was the signature A-Rod moment in relation to the Jays. But that said, like you mentioned with Jeter, I don't think there's any shortage of Alex Rodriguez moments in general in terms of his impact on baseball or – you know, the other obviously interference one that comes to mind is him trying to knock the ball away in the ALCS against the
Red Sox.
Out of
Bronson Arroyo's glove?
Yeah.
Yep.
I think A-Rod has a long and checkered history of great moments. And, you know, unfortunately, it seems like he's going to be remembered more for the things he screwed up than the things he did well. And, you know, I heard somebody point this out the other day, and I think it's very true, is we know what A-Rod did wrong, and we, you know, but there could be just as many people that we don't know about who are doing the exact same things. And some of them could have immaculate reputations amongst people who follow baseball, and we just don't know that they were doing the same things as Alex Rodriguez was. So I'm in the camp of people that isn't particularly offended or bothered by Alex Rodriguez's transgressions in baseball. What about you? Do you have a signature moment that's doesn't involve him trying to, I don't know, impede a defender from making a routine play?
His 600th home run, actually. He hit his 600th home run off of Sean Markham at Yankee Stadium. And I was so mad that a Blue Jay gave up his 600th home run. It always seemed like there was a couple years there where it seemed like every big homer that came up, it was a Blue Jay, somehow was related to it, or an ex-Blue Jay or whatever. So I was just sad and kind of mad. It's like, couldn't you just pitch better? Could you not give that up? Because now we get to watch him dance around the bases and get the ball and everything else, and Sean Markham has to stand out there on the mound and take it. So that's my A-Rod moment versus the Blue Jays. You say there are some players where we don't know what they did. There are a couple of players who I will not smear on this podcast who showed up in the Mitchell report that shouldn't have ever been released or public, but they're beloved. Okay. Right. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. I think it has a lot more to do with A-Rod's unusual personality. We'll leave it at that. That he's just not a very people person. And that's led him to have a lot more difficulties than he would if he were really a charismatic fella. Because you can get through a lot in baseball by smiling at the right times and shaking hands with the right people.
Yeah.
And lastly, Prince Fielder, you wanted to give a shout out to Prince, who apparently his neck injuries are going to make it darn near impossible for him to make a comeback. That was just a brief tweet from Ken Rosenthal tonight. I haven't read all the details yet.
Take it away.
Right. Yeah. Well, I wanted to give Prince Fielder a gold star because, you know, over the course of his career, despite being a very, very effective left-handed power hitter for a lot of years, Fielder was the brunt of a lot of jokes and comments and highlights that, you know, admittedly I enjoyed, and I thought, you know, I thought it was hilarious when he went into the stands and ate that fan's nachos and all that stuff. But, you know, Prince Fielder succeeded in baseball despite, you know, not looking like an average baseball player. And I just want to, I think it's important to remember and point out that, you know, an average person could spend their whole life working out, getting super fit, and training to play professional baseball, you know, live in the cage, and they wouldn't be able to play baseball as well as Prince Fielder. They probably wouldn't even be able to run as fast as Prince Fielder. And I think it's just worth noting now that he's probably on his way out of baseball that he was a really great player for a really long time, despite not having a lot of the physical tools that, you know, most Major League Baseball players have. And, you know, good on him for everything he's accomplished in baseball.
And I think that's a good gold star to give. I think he really gave his honest effort, and to go through the herniated discs in his back and really try and come back and everything else to, you know, he you could tell he really still wanted to play baseball. I respect that.
Oh, absolutely.
I totally respect that. So we are getting towards the end of the podcast. At this point, I usually ask Josh if he has a final thought. But Josh isn't here right now. So, Nick, do you have... I used to ask Chris, and Chris would, like, 50% of the time, tops, have a final thought. Do you have one?
Yeah, well, I guess the one final thought I would give, and not to try to open the Pandora's box that is the Sanchez debate again, but the one... If I could focus on one small part of the Sanchez debate that I personally find a little confusing or perplexing, is this: once in a while we talk about how the Jays have more knowledge about Aaron Sanchez's medicals and his health, and that they know they're doing this because they know more than we do. And I just find it as an odd kind of position to take, given that we could basically use that kind of reasoning to justify any position the Jays take. You know, the Jays are batting Kevin Pillar leadoff. That seems odd. He doesn't get on base very much. But the Jays know more about Kevin Pillar than we do, as the very obvious blatant counterexample. So my final thought would just be, in all of the Sanchez stuff, I don't want us to fall too much back on just kind of appealing to the Jays' authority in that area, because it seems to me like from everything they've said both to the media and how they've seemed to deal with talking to the other players about it, they don't seem to have a very strict or rigid plan that they've kind of been employing since the season began, which again just leads me to think I'm not sure that if they do have more information, it's not definitive in the way that I think some people would suggest they do have stronger information about them or about Sanchez and why we're doing why they're doing what they're doing with him.
Interesting. So I have a totally different vein to take, is that I read this week that the Blue Jays are on track to lead the American League in attendance, which will break the Yankees, I think it's 7-year run of doing so. So, A, suck it, Yankees. B, hey, folks, keep buying tickets. This team needs you because they took on a whole bunch of extra salary, and gosh knows, we all want to see them in the playoffs every year. Also, that's really cool because I think Toronto is a baseball town. All you got to do is give them a team worth watching. And on that note, we're going to bring it home, which means that you have been Nick Dyka on the Twitter at Nick Dyka.
Yep, that's it.
And I have been Greg Wisniewski at Coolhead2010. And this has been Artificial Turf Wars episode number 24. And we'll talk to you again next week.